you, dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
So tonight we have on the line Christopher O'Brien. Hello, Christopher.
Hey, Andrew.
How's it going?
Good. I must say I've done a little bit of research on your podcast, and I'm actually very impressed. I feel that your show is cutting edge and really has the real potential of covering a real void, a real dark kind of shadow spot, a blind spot within the paranormal community. Not much emphasis is given to the Western esoteric tradition and out of the box thinking. I think it's really important that you've formulated the show in the way that you have.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah, so I'm only doing it about stuff that I really, get off on, I guess, for lack of a better term. But I really appreciate that. Thank you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into this stalking the tricksters?
Well, I am not an expert. I've never claimed to be an expert. People put that tag on me, and I get embarrassed. There are no experts in this field. Only individuals with more creative questions. Basically, I have always had a real fascination with the paranormal, the occult, sort of conspiracy government theories, and the kind of stuff that I lived for 12 years in New York, so I didn't bring these things up when I was in New York City. Kind of social suicide, very low class sociological subjects to profess an interest in. So for many years until 1989, when I moved out to the West, I didn't really discuss these types of subjects with strangers or whatever. Of course, all my college buddies and my friends, they all knew that I was into cutting edge subject matter, but it wasn't something that I kind of wore on my sleeve, as unfortunately the patch I have on now does. But I moved out to Colorado in the San Luis Valley, which is south central Colorado, north central New Mexico. Taos would be at the very bottom of the geological valley, and then it's about 150 miles. It's roughly a football-shaped valley. It's the largest alpine valley in the world. Totally surrounded by mountains, radar invisible below 18,000 feet, that's important. Huh. And there's a variety and intensity of documented paranormal occurrences there that I think are unrivaled anywhere in this country. I arrived there and spent 13 years investigating several thousand reports that range from around 200, unusual livestock death cases. Every type of UFO sighting you can imagine, elementals, cryptozoological creatures, Bigfoot, these weird undulating dimensional forms that I've dubbed prairie dragons. I've investigated and researched portal areas, underground bases, unusual military activity, unexplained paraphysical events, unusual weather, crop circles in virgin forests on the Continental Divide. Instead of crops, you have 100-foot trees laid over. Just wow. Pretty much every type of unusual occurrence, hauntings, poltergeists, whatever. Just about everything that you can think of at one point or another from 1989 to 2002, I investigated. And I've written 3 books about my San Luis Valley investigations. Everybody in the book went on record. They signed release forms. I worked with 5 county sheriff's departments. Someone called me the unofficial deputy of weirdness for about, 10,000-15,000 square miles. I started out really innocently. I didn't believe this stuff. I was, jaded, cynical, from Manhattan. This is all a bunch of wishful thinking, aliens, yeah, right, we're the aliens, that was my attitude going in.
Right.
And I quickly really realized that we were dealing with a lot more, a much more complex scenario that probably didn't have much to do with extraterrestrials. It was all closed system. This biosphere is producing these phenomenal effects, and we'll get into that, I guess, quite a bit.
Okay, yeah, fantastic. So, what led you up to stalking the tricksters and into researching the trickster phenomenon?
Well, my first book came out in 96, my second book, 99, Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, which was kind of the story of writing the first two books, came out in 2007. And between, you know, 1993, when I first started writing articles, appearing on TV, and being fairly visible, between 93 and 2002, when I moved, I, you know, had been dogged by some people for only reporting what happened and not really diving in and coming up with some sort of explanation or theory to explain what all this kaleidoscope type activity, what it all was due to.
Right.
So it took me about 10 years to really formulate a theory in my mind that could potentially explain all these different divergent, you know, so-called paranormal phenomena, and factor in the military stuff, factor in the unusual weather, the aberrant societal behavior, stuff that ebbed and flowed along with the paranormal activity. It would take us, you know, we could do 3 or 4 shows just illustrating the incredible database that I've accumulated, and look at the patterning, the things that have led me in the direction of the trickster, basically. And this is not a a theory. You know, the book came out in November, and I've had some feedback on it, and I think essentially the mainstream of ufology, for instance, has totally ignored it. They just don't want to go there. There's, you know, most people that are into UFOs and that whole field, you know, are pretty much programmed to believe that the extraterrestrial hypothesis, I rather kind of refer to it as the extraterrestrial assumption. These people don't want to hear anything that suggests that all these strange events could be due to something that we are generating as a culture or as a subculture, you know, potentially within the collective, but all encompassed in a closed system biosphere that's, you know, blue marble spinning in space. It's all generated from here. I think the vast majority of it, I mean, we can't factor anything in or anything out. I'm not saying that aliens don't exist. I mean, the mathematical probability of billions of different types of life forms, trillions of life forms in the universe is obvious. But I don't think we're important enough for anything out there to come here and be seen collecting soil and plant samples since the Middle Ages. I mean, what's up with that?
Yeah.
We could put something in orbit around this Earth the size of a beer keg and find out anything we would want to know about this planet just with our fairly primitive high technology. So I feel something else is going on, something that is highly mercurial, very difficult to pin down, very difficult to get any sort of patterning. I would identify patterns within my database, moon phase correlations, days of the week, hours of the night or day, and as soon as I would identify a pattern, I would get the supportive data to support that I was on the right track, and then it would go exactly the opposite. It would do a 180-degree shift. It would do everything the exact opposite.
Right.
So to me, I've always had a sense that there was some tricksterish element involved in the paranormal, in culture, in society, in our everyday, day-to-day life. There's
right.
something that's organizing, that's somehow structuring coincidence and synchronicity, and is like the programmer for some big, giant, incredible software program.
Could you tell us what the basic thesis of the book is, the basic idea?
Well, Sigmund Freud kind of revolutionized scientific thinking in terms of looking at the human mind, the conscious and unconscious state, and the superconscious state, and, you know, the whole Freudian system of psychoanalysts and the whole field of psychology has kind of sprung from Freud's groundbreaking work.
Right.
Well, Freud's star pupil was Carl Gustav Jung, and I am a real fan of Carl Jung's work. And Jung took Freud one step further. He said, well, if all these things are manifest within the individual unconscious, then there must be some sort of overarching, all-encompassing, super cultural consciousness or human consciousness that it operates on a sub-level. So we have this amorphous pool of very primal symbols and characters and images that we all share, even if, you know, if we're a bushman in the Kalahari, or, you know, Kogi in the jungles of South America, or an Ainu in Japan. We all share certain very basic primal symbols or archetypes, as he applied the term to these symbols. And they include the shadow, which is the most basic. You know, when you're a little kid, there's shadows in your closet and you think it's a monster. I mean, that's a very basic archetypal symbol. Then he also included the animus and the anima, which is the female side of the male side of the female,
right.
And the god, the goddess, the hero. But the most primal one of these archetypes, if you will, the most primal one that has features, that has personification, that is identifiable with features, is the trickster. The mother, the child, the shadow, those are the most basic, but they're all formless in terms of features, so that you can identify which you know who it is. The trickster is the first one that has facial features, and these are ascribed by indigenous cultures. They survive. The trickster survives into the modern world today. What do you do when you go out on Halloween? What do? You go out and go trick or treat.
Right.
Where do clowns come from? What is up with a stage magician who does sleight of hand? These are all surviving vestiges of trickster energy in the modern world. The trickster thrived for thousands of years in a matriarchal, pantheistic cultural system. In other words, before there were cities, before there were kings, before there was some sort of ruling authority, the trickster was a very vibrant part of indigenous culture.
Right, before there was monotheism.
And a switch from the matriarchy to a patriarchy, which is also very important.
Right.
A trickster is neither male or female. It's not good or bad. It's not black or white. It's not old or young. The trickster is something I think I equate it as a 3,000-pound gorilla that is in every single person's living room, and it's drumming its toes on the coffee table. And, you know, everybody is in denial that we have this amazingly powerful archetypal form that manifests every day in all of our lives. So if you look at the trickster as a marginalized figure who, you know, when Christianity came along, the trickster, you know, was awarded the designation of Satan, of Lucifer, of a devil, of a demon. They needed the trickster to be marginalized to become the bad guy.
Right.
So as a result, the trickster had to go into the closet. The trickster has been operating clandestinely, has been sneaking a peek and scooting and shooting in culture, totally out of the limelight. And that's important to you know, I think your listeners to realize. The trickster has been operative all the way through history, but has been marginalized by Christianity as a bad guy, and other cultures as well. The jinn, the genies in Islamic traditions, is an example of Islam marginalizing the trickster and actually coming up with a very ingenious breakdown of trickster society, you know,
right.
In terms of the genie. There's 12 main types. They all have kids. They have lifespans. Certain genies are responsible for certain types of tasks in herding and, you know, cavorting with modern, fully incarnate human beings like you and I. So everywhere you go around the world, there are tricksters. And they all have different names. There's thousands of them. Each trickster is slightly different, but they all have a commonality. They all have the ability to shapeshift.
Well, I think your book is kind of unique in that you identify them all as such. I don't know if all the beings and entities that you talk about in your book were necessarily thought of as tricksters before you wrote this book.
No, they weren't. One of the important things to remember is that classic anthropology really has only identified the trickster for 130 or 140 years. In other words, Daniel Britton, when he coined the term trickster to kind of define this particular force within the culture, I mean, that was back in the 1870s. And when I tried to research where he first used the term, I couldn't find it.
Huh.
Which is very interesting to me because, I mean, how could it be any different? When was the trickster first defined? Well, the trickster won't let you know.
Right.
And classic anthropology has been stuck, in my opinion, in a rut. They have very emphatically said the trickster is not self-aware. It's unconscious. And it does not evolve. And to me, that's ludicrous. There's nothing within our Einsteinian or Newtonian universe that does not evolve.
Yeah.
And if that's true, if I can refute that particular assertion that the trickster does not evolve, then that means that there is some sort of process within the trickster archetype that is becoming self-aware. It can't be unconscious forever. If everything evolves, then it is evolving into awareness. Now, one of the things that's really important to remember about all trickster archetypes around the world that we all share on a deep, you know, subcultural, subconscious level, or a collective unconscious level, I think it would be more appropriate. The trickster, I think, from continent to continent to continent, the trickster's primary role seems to be to topple static structures.
Yeah.
To supply novelty and change, to topple the powers that be. As soon as things get too entrenched, too set in stone, you know, you have the haves and the have-nots, the trickster comes in and pulls that key little thing out of the foundation to topple the house of cards.
Right.
It supplies novelty and change to create change within static structures. Now, the other thing that the trickster, in all versions, it boils down to supplying somehow technology or new understanding to humans. In other words, if you look at the trickster, you can divide it up into three different distinct types. You have the most primordial, the most basic trickster, which tends to be an anthropomorphized view of an animal that a particular subculture will think has tricksterous qualities. Coyote is the most famous and most obvious one for people in America.
Right.
Coyote and Roadrunner. Actually, Roadrunner is more of a trickster than Coyote. You know, Roadrunner always wins, so it out-tricksters the trickster, which I love. That's my favorite cartoon. Coyote is one, Raven, Spider, the Great Hare.
The Fox.
Well, Fox is one of those tricksters who only appears in a few pantheons of trickster forms, mainly Renald, the famous Fox trickster in France, whose claim to fame was poking fun at the Pope.
Right.
So I do identify with that particular form quite readily. Yeah. So anyway, that's the primordial anthropomorphized trickster form. Those are the most ancient. They tend to change nature, the very essence of Gaia, for the benefit of man.
Okay.
Like Raven brought daylight into existence so man could grow crops.
Right.
I
love that story.
Yeah, the Maui Kappa is another one. They actually pushed the sun further up in the sky to help humankind. They're smoking mirror in the, you know, the Mayan or the South American tradition, or the Central American and Yucatan tradition. There's Iktomi, which is a Midwestern American spider version. He has an exact like twin in Africa called Anansi. So these are animals that are given tricksterish qualities by a culture, and they are responsible for changing nature to benefit man. Now you go to the second of the three trickster types, and that is the tragic hero. These are the ones that I think most people, are, at least in today's modern world, might be familiar with. Loki, the famous trickster from Scandinavia, definitely supplied technology. He supplied the fishing hook to humanity. These tragic hero figures tend to work in opposition to the gods. The first type of trickster doesn't have to deal with gods.
Right.
He deals with like a creator force, but not individual pantheistic gods. The tragic hero has to deal with god forms. So he brings technology to humans, but usually he does it in opposition to the gods' wishes and gets punished. Prometheus is probably the most famous of these tragic hero trickster forms. Prometheus was the Greek god that defied Zeus and brought fire to humanity. And for as a punishment for transgressions, he was chained to a rock in the Carpathians, or the I forget which mountains, and he had his liver pecked out by Zeus's eagle every day, and it would heal, and then the next day it would get pecked out, for eternity.
Why was
so
his
you have
liver?
The tragic hero type. Go ahead.
Why his liver? I always wondered that.
Well, the liver is, besides the heart, probably the most important, the lungs too. The heart, liver, and lungs are the most important organs. So the liver filters everything that we take in. So that is a good question. I need to think about that. Why not the lungs or the heart?
Yeah, no, that's kind of an aside, but I have always wondered why it was the liver and not, but anyhow,
out of the three major organs, harming your liver allows you to live the longest. If you harm the lungs, you die. If you harm the heart, you die. But the liver, you can survive. So it's probably the slow death scenario.
Gotcha. Well, so okay, we got the anthropomorphized animals, and then we got the tragic heroes. And what's number three here?
Number three would be the form of trickster. I think that most people would be most readily able to identify with, or at least know about, and that is the shamanic trickster. It's a human that uses trickster methodology and tools to enact a tricksterish agenda. Now, the first two types are acting altruistically. They're kind of in a symbiotic relationship with humanity. They have no agenda. They don't realize what they're doing is good or bad. They don't realize they are, in some sense of the word, unconscious in that they're reactive to situations. They don't have any perceived agenda. Usually that agenda turns out positive for humanity. The third type of trickster, the shamanic trickster, is the first inkling of the trickster being able to express consciousness and have an idea, have an agenda. So shamans, for thousands of years, were direct conduits between individuals and divinity. It was only with the rise of urban culture, converting from a matriarchy to a patriarchy, that we see urban centers, kings arise in culture, at least in this, you know, current fourth world. And the shaman was marginalized and put in the background and only exists in rural indigenous cultures because it was replaced by the priest class.
Right.
Now, the priest class, instead of being a conduit for your individual divinity, they're a gatekeeper or a doorman.
Right.
They say, you got to look like this or do this or do that in order to have connection with some sort of divinity. So the priest class has supplanted the shaman. However, the shaman hasn't totally gone away. We have shaman in every continent. We have shamanic figures. And some of the more famous recent tricksters, I mentioned Michael Jackson, has very tricksterish qualities, but my favorite is Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
There you go. $6 billion. He very artfully, in a tricksterish manner.
Or it was $50 billion.
Well, 60, but who's counting?
Oh, 60. I thought you said 6. I'm sorry.
No, 60.
Yeah.
$60 billion he milked out of a lot of people that had a lot of greed and a lust for unreasonable returns on their investment. Houdini is another classic trickster. Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater Group that did the 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast. Aleister Crowley, probably, you know, Dollars and Donuts, my favorite trickster figure.
I definitely want to get into Aleister Crowley at a little bit of depth, for sure. I don't know if this would be
so
good.
So mote it be.
Yeah. Because I, even before picking up your book, I definitely think of Aleister Crowley as the kind of arch-trickster of the modern era.
Well, he was the suppository that helped evacuate the bowels of the Victorian age.
That's a great way to put it.
That was his job, man. All this black tantra and his sex magic and all, you know, all the outrageous stuff that he did around the turn of the century, up into the, 30s during his heyday, that was all designed to topple the static, entrenched, anal, constipated Victorian age, which he did a marvelous job. I can't think of anybody from that time period that can rival his tricksterish role, in the 1890s, around the turn of the century.
He was totally aware of it, too.
Oh, absolutely. And, he has such a bad reputation. He was called publicly the world's most wickedest man and all this. But he did everything he could to bolster that image, to blow it up and make it into this huge thing, because the bigger his bad reputation became, the more effective his tricksterous antics became. And, the whole Golden Dawn system of magic, the offshoots of Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, Ordo Templi Orientis, anything having to do with Hermeticism, the Gnostic experience, establishing a direct divinity with the brother of God, not God the supreme being, but a contemporary equal, which is the difference between Christianity, Islam, and even the Vedic tradition. Humans are put in in subservience or in a lower position than divinity. In the Western tradition, Hermeticism, and not in the Gnostic traditions, you're on par with the Creator, and I love that. That's really important, and that's one thing. Looking through your first few shows, that I kind of got a sense that you're going in that direction. I really do support that.
Yeah, I've definitely geeked out on the Western esoteric tradition for a few years now, for sure.
Geeked out?
stayed up late, yeah, listening to the classical station on the radio and reading through esoteric weirdo books, and not able to explain it to my friends and family, I guess.
That's the way magic and theory and practice, if you can get through it.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, that's probably one of those books I'd take to a desert island. Let's see. I was taking notes when I was reading the book. Okay, there's this Wendigo entity, this big, foul-smelling, yellow-toothed, hairy monster that's up, like, in the Great Lakes region.
Well, yeah, central Canada and, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, where it gets 40 below and nasty during the winter.
Right, and this Wendigo character was usually accused of eating human flesh, and I thought it was really interesting that you connected that to the Greyhound bus murder and this character Swift Runner.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Wendigo is a, I think is, you know, if I look at the potential development process within the subculture there that came up with the whole idea of the Wendigo, it would seem to me that probably one of the things that people in that part of the world feared the most, you know, when you're living in a wigwam or a teepee with moccasins at 40 below, one of the things that I would probably be in the most fear about is not having enough to eat. So it seems to me that the Wendigo has evolved out of this primal fear of cannibalism. Because if there's nothing left to eat, then the person next to you is a food source. So the Wendigo is cutting to the chase. I mean, obviously, I could actually talk about a half hour on this subject. But the Wendigo, I think, is a reaction to an innate primal fear of cannibalism. And the ultimate, biggest of all the trickster forms that I've found has sprung from that primal fear. The Wendigo, they're 15 to 30 feet tall, supposedly. And they are very similar to werewolves in that they are involuntarily Wendigoized. In other words, they get, like, a werewolf bites a victim, and then the full moon comes and the person turns into a werewolf, whether he likes it or not. Wendigo is very similar in that he victimizes certain people, turns them into Wendigos, but they only manifest into the Wendigo form at certain times. So you have this super Bigfoot that's cannibalistic in one sense of the word. I don't really... Wendigos, I think, are totally separate from Bigfoot. But you have this giant hairy guy that can be as tall as 30 feet, extremely fast, swoops down, grabs people, eats them. And this is like the ultimate, in my, you know, interpretation of the trickster, this would be the ultimate trickster boogeyman. Now, in terms of that strange case in Canada where the kid was, you know, riding on the bus going from the East Coast to the West Coast on the Trans-Canada Highway and out of nowhere attacks his seatmate, a stranger, a perfect stranger sitting next to him, knifes him to death, cuts his head off, and then there were rumors and some sense, at least in my research, that there was cannibalism involved in his act. He held off the cops for a while. He was brandishing the guy's head and very weird kind of stuff. And one of his comments in terms of his defense was that he had been stricken by some sort of Wendigo.
Right.
And this was not something the media really wanted to spend much time discussing. To them, it was a cut-and-dry case of a madman, you know, flipping out. But some interesting elements were brought in. There had been a very high-profile article on Wendigos that appeared in his local paper, I think in Toronto, the week before he left to travel to the West Coast. And there's some indication that he may have somehow read this article, and there may have been some sort of triggering mechanism that occurred.
Well, wasn't he delivering the paper?
I believe so. I think he was a paper boy for the was it the Toronto Sun? You know, I don't have the book in front of me.
I think you say here Edmonton, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he was in Edmonton. I think he was further east. But anyway, I just bring, throughout the book, I try to use modern examples of potential tricksters to illustrate points about a primordial force that has been manifesting for thousands of years. So whenever I could, I look for modern examples of potential tricksterish behavior to kind of drive my point home that the trickster is this, you know, 3,000-pound gorilla sitting in all of our living rooms drumming his toes on the coffee table.
Right. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that this guy on the Greyhound bus, Lee, would have perhaps run across this article about the Wendigo and then 10 days later goes apeshit. That was just an interesting connection.
No pun intended.
No pun intended, right. I thought it was interesting. There was a tale in here about I thought, you know, the part of the book that really gave me chills down my spine was reading about these police and these people driving through New Mexico, and this being like latches onto the side of their car.
The skinwalker.
The skinwalker, right. And there was this officer that went off into the woods to try to find it and got a headache and was nauseous after a certain point in time, and his fellow officer had to help
him.
Just
one of many law enforcement accounts that I dug up. I only used a few.
Well, let's get into the skinwalker.
Well, again, now we're dealing with a shamanic form of trickster. It's a human manifestation of trickster energy. Not many people know about skinwalkers, and those that do, most of them feel, you know, just as a gut reaction that skinwalkers are negative. Not necessarily so. Skinwalkers have the ability to heal, they have the ability to enact positive change in conformity to will, as well as a nefarious ability to mess people up, you know. So skinwalkers have been painted into a very negative place. However, they do have the ability to be very positive if the price is right. Basically, they're trickster mercenaries. They're dark adepts within the Athabascan Diné tradition, Apache and Navajo mostly. Most people don't know that the Diné arrived just shortly before the Spanish arrived in North America. The Diné are relative newcomers, the Apache and Navajo, into North America. They arrived in the 1300s and 1400s.
Huh.
And one of the things that I found out is that Diné people have a real problem with death. And there's been quite a taboo that has become very entrenched in their subcultural system involving death. For instance, if a Navajo dies in a hogan, they do a blessing ceremony and then it's left, it's abandoned. Nobody will ever live there again. Just if somebody dies in the house.
Huh.
This is more of a traditional view of their traditions, but one of the things that has sprung up in the Diné tradition, as well as all Native American traditions for that matter, or any tradition, African, Eurasian, Australian, South American, is this dark adept, this black magician, who has the ability to, you can hire him to like mess people up, to put spells on people, Voodoo, Candomblé, these are other belief systems that have similar type figures. But the skinwalker is really important, I think. I live in Arizona, so, you know, he's a local. So it's really important because I think it has the most obvious clues about the true nature of the shamanic form of trickster. He can don the skin of a particular animal, usually a deer or a wolf, a coyote, a bear, and he's able to transform or shapeshift himself into that animal form. Now, if he's really in a hurry and needs to go from point A to point B really quick, many traditions state that he can turn or she can turn herself into a ball of energy and shoot off across the desert from point A to point B as a glittering ball of light traveling very quickly. And believe it or not, you know, in all the hundreds, thousands of reports that I fielded over 13 years in the San Luis Valley, from the south end of the valley in New Mexico, I got reports of witches, of skinwalkers, you know, traveling really quick. Instead of somebody calling up and saying, I saw a UFO orb, they call up and report a witch or a skinwalker. And I always was totally intrigued by that. By that subcultural interpretation. So skinwalkers they've got pretty amazing abilities. They're able to, if you lock eyes with one, supposedly, he can jump inside you and his spirit can take over your body and make you do things and say things and go places without your permission, but you're totally aware that he's doing it. I mean, it sounds like the ultimate nightmare.
Right.
the cases that you mentioned are the most common supposed skin marker encounters, and that is driving down a dark road in the res or somewhere in the Southwest, and you see somebody hitchhiking on the road. You stop to, you know, ask them if they need help. They're in the middle of nowhere. They don't answer you. You say, well, you ask again. They ignore you. So you keep driving, and all of a sudden you look out the side of your car, and the hitchhiker is running along the car with you, looking at you, and freaks you out. So what do? You speed up, but he keeps pace with your car. I've had law enforcement reports that state on the record that the skinwalker was able to keep up with a squad car going 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would freak me out.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
I try to stay off the res at night if at all, you know, possible. But, you know, again, I really do sense that the skinwalker archetype is could really give us an insight into possibly an ancient school of rapidly disappearing knowledge, where you have a few adepts that are keeping some sort of magical, high strange, paranormal ability alive. They can shapeshift, turn into energy balls, do miraculous healings, manifest changes in community and individual behavior. I really do have a sense that there are people, individuals with this ability, but they're very few, and the knowledge is dying as we, you know, progress into the modern age. So,
well, I know that the tribes that skinwalkers tend to come from, they are very hesitant to speak about the skinwalkers for obvious reasons. But
yeah.
I was kind of curious, like, there has to be some kind of initiatory structure or, like, group of skinwalkers who, like, if you want to be a skinwalker or you're, you know, tapped from birth to be one, that you have to learn this from people or something,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you don't just spontaneously become one,
no,
or do you?
No,
I mean,
no. It's a for lack of a better term, it's a medicine society. It's a school of esoteric knowledge. I know somebody who had an uncle who attempted to entice this friend of mine, actually a coworker who I worked with for a number of years, who's half Navajo or half Lakota, half Hopi. And he actually underwent the initial stages of training to become a skinwalker. There's some branch of his family that were involved with the skinwalker society, like, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And he went through the initiatory up just short of the initiatory rites. And unfortunately, when he found out that he had to kill a close family member and then be involved in a cannibalistic ritual, he said no. And he actually backed down from the whole thing. And
so are these medicine societies separate from the rest of the tribe?
All medicine societies are separate from the tribe in one sense of the word. They're all, you know, autonomous. They're all self-determined. They exist within a collective of medicine societies within the subculture, but they have their own secrets, their own rituals, their own agenda. It doesn't matter which tribe you go to, anywhere in North America, you have your clan system and you have your medicine societies. So,
okay.
Yeah, they are separate.
Huh, yeah, that's really interesting. One thing that wasn't mentioned in the book and I wanted to ask you about, because it seems kind of, from my experiences at least, to be a very tricksterish phenomenon or harbinger of the trickster archetype, is hallucinogenic or entheogenic substances like psilocybin
compounds.
Mushrooms, compounds, right. I hate the word drugs. But
yeah.
Psilocybin or mescaline or peyote, could you speak to that?
How about dimethyltryptamine?
Yeah, DMT for sure. I mean,
well, yeah, it's funny. I was just up at the, I do guided tours for a company that does private tours up to the Grand Canyon. I've been up there, 150, 160 times. Only place in the world I could go that many times and never get bored. And it's funny, you should mention that. My last trip 2 days ago, I saw a Datura plant coming up.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I don't know how many millions of people are going to walk by that thing, you know, over the next, you know, year or whatever, and not have any idea that that is an extremely powerful, you know, disassociative hallucinogenic that's just there for the picking, you know.
Right.
So, in answer to your question, yeah, the shamanic tradition generally features the medicinal and sacred use of particular psychoactive compounds. And to kind of fess up, I am quite a psychonaut.
Yeah.
I've been there and back more times than entire towns of people, probably. I spent many years as a youth as a psychotropic astronaut and have been there and done that and actually cultivated sacraments. So I do have quite a bit of experience, which I did not mention in the book, and I'm kind of glad actually you brought this up. Psychoactive compounds, I believe, are our quickest, most direct conduit to some sort of divinity slash paranormal realm.
Yeah.
I have devoured every single audio tape interview that I could find that was recorded of Terence McKenna.
Oh, yeah.
Terence McKenna is one of the most important figures of the 20th century. Gordon Wasson, who was the first one to really expose cubensis, you know, which is, cubensis is the species of mushroom that is psychoactive and psychotropic, the most safe one.
Right.
And Gordon Wasson did an extensive write-up on the magic mushrooms of Oaxaca back in I think, the 50s or early 60s for Life magazine. Aldous Huxley is somebody else that I, you know, really urge your listeners to read. His book, The Doors of Perception, yeah. I think very instrumental in my thinking. Obviously, Carlos Castaneda comes to mind, but he's a trickster figure. You can't really trust the reality of a lot of his work. I've read probably 7, 8, 9 books by Castaneda. There,
well, Robert another Anton person,
Wilson is another one.
Yeah, yeah. Robert Anton Wilson is one of my biggest heroes for sure. But also, obviously, you know, the person who kind of heralded this sort of investigation is again Crowley.
Yeah. Yeah, not so much in the psychoactive realm, but
well,
yeah,
he was a big fan of peyote, I believe.
Yeah, but he did not really publish much of his psychoactive substance use. He didn't really publish the results of some of the things that he was involved with. That's a little bit before this whole period.
Right.
You don't really see modern investigations into psychoactive compounds until Wasson in the late 50s, early 60s. Of course, Albert Hofmann discovered the synthetic form of, you know, the rye ergot, which is LSD,
right.
Back in the late 30s, which he then revisited in the 40s and was able to synthesize LSD. This was the realm of real cutting-edge, out-of-the-box psychiatry and the intelligence communities. The CIA is probably the single most prolific exponent of psychoactive compounds.
Right.
Their experiments in the 50s and 60s with college students pretty much inspired, in some sense, the psychedelic 60s.
Sure, MK Ultra was the most widespread investigation of these.
Yeah, Frank Olson and getting pushed out to what 14th floor window in New York back in 1953, and
right.
They did quite a number of experiments at Fort Detrick, Sidney Gottlieb. Anybody
yep.
out there want to do some research on the real cancer man from the X-Files, Sidney Gottlieb
yep.
at Fort Detrick, the Army Chemical Corps. All these types of programs were put forth, but these people, you know, they didn't really have a clue. They were missing the forest for the trees. What they were trying to do is be parasitic and use these compounds for an agenda, when these compounds are actually, I think, naturally devised to be a conduit for an individual divinity and gnosis and understanding and clarity. So it's very difficult to use that innate quality for some sort of nefarious agenda. In other words, you know, truth serum, incapacitate, you know, enemies, troops, that sort of thing. It just doesn't work that way. A very good movie, I think. I'm not sure who was in it. I think it was Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah.
Susan Sarandon's husband,
Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins, yeah, I think was in that. Very interesting film. Lots of interesting clues in there. So, yeah, psychoactive compounds, shaman societies and shamanic use, you know, has occurred for thousands of years and continues today. The ayahuasca arrows down in South America. There's peyote cults in Oaxaca. I mean, gosh, they feed their infants peyote tea down in certain villages in Oaxaca, down in central Mexico, for instance. This is a very, it's like a blind spot, I think, in Western thinking. I think most people don't realize that we have an express train to divinity with psychoactive substances. A combination of psychoactive substances and ritual occult knowledge is a really scary thing for the powers that be.
Yeah.
And that's an area which, I really appreciate your the whole concept of your show. I think it's important because you're going to be dealing with that particular subject, I think, time and time again.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was definitely my bread and butter for a long time and still is. And I bring up the whole...
Let me know if I'm getting too long-winded and I'm talking too much here.
No, not at all. I wanted to tie this back to the trickster. I won't necessarily share the anecdote, but there was an instance in a friend's backyard a few years ago, one summer night. We ate a bunch of mushrooms, and while I was reading your book, I was constantly thinking of this experience that I had walking around this backyard where the trickster was as alive and well and in my face as it ever has been. And I just remember everywhere that I looked, if I looked at a tree or the grass or my hand, somehow the face of the green man from Celtic, you know, mythology would form, and it was just grinning, and it wasn't good or evil, it was both, and it was just kind of like that experience in my life was when this trickster element or archetype was so vigorously shoved in my
revealed.
Face.
Revealed,
and it was the lifeblood of the universe, you know, like the blood of the universe shooting through the universe's veins was this trickster element that was grinning and insane and horny and life-affirming, but also dangerous and kind of scary. And that was one of the, you know, best experiences, you know, in my whole life. But I was definitely thinking of that while I was reading your book. So
cool.
I'm glad we got into this hallucinogen thing. Hey, we're just at an hour right now. Are you down for talk? I mean, I definitely need to talk to you some more. Do you have the time?
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay. I figured it would be 2 hours.
Okay, sweet. Okay, so I'm going to stop this for a second, make sure the file...
Yeah, take a break. I got to take a leak.
Yeah. Okay, sweet. Yeah, I got to do the same. So I'll call you in like 5 minutes. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Okay. And thus ends part one of episode 6 of Panopticon Podcast with Christopher O'Brien, author of Stalking the Tricksters. And stay tuned for part 2, where we get into even more interesting territories regarding this awesome subject. Enjoy.